everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for February 2017. I'm joined once again by my faithful co-host and friend, Tim Nelson.
How you doing, John? Good to be here.
Doing all right. Good to be here. Yeah. Now, Tim, this podcast is going out on Valentine's Day. So, happy Valentine's Day, everyone.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Buy a little something for your significant other. And, Tim, in case I haven't told you lately, I love you, man.
Have I told you lately? Is that Rod Stewart,
I think? I wouldn't know.
I think it is.
Okay, Rod Stewart. So, love's in the air, man. That's what it's all about. And we thought this would be the perfect day to talk about a movie that's basically like a deconstruction of love, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And that is our topic for today. So definitely not your typical love story. Let's be honest about that.
You
right?
might not want to watch this on Valentine's
right.
Day.
This isn't When Harry Met Sally. This isn't Sleepless in Seattle. It's a little bit of a different take
this
on love.
This may not be the like somebody reaches over to hold your hand during the movie.
Right.
Kind of movie.
It's true. But I think that the way that this movie examines love by kind of churning it on its side actually gets to the heart of the matter more than your typical romantic movie. So that's my take, but we'll get to that.
There's not two grooms or two brides.
Right. Definitely not. No runaway brides. No.
No airport scenes that I can remember.
No fake orgasms. No. We're
taking it to the next level,
there
man.
There it is. I said it. Someone had to say
yeah.
it.
Yeah, that's right. Harry Met Sally.
When Harry Met Sally.
That's
you.
A great scene. It's yeah. iconic. If you haven't watched it, you should watch it. It is just hilarious.
I watched it on TV on New Year's Eve. It was on there, and it's just one of those movies that you just have to keep watching. Yeah, and once it's on, you suffer through the commercials and everything.
Yep.
Anyway, let's talk about this movie because, Tim, I forgot how amazing this movie is. I mean, I hadn't seen it, I think, for about 10, 11 years, and I just watched it 2 days ago. This movie is amazing.
Yep.
Really, genuinely. How was the rewatch for you? What grabbed you on the rewatch? Like, had it been a long time since you saw it, too?
I saw it last year, and then I've seen it twice, I think, before that. I saw it in the theater in 2004 in Pasadena.
I did too.
Just where
in college. I was not in Pasadena. I was a freshman in college, but yes, we both partook of it in the theater. That's good.
Yeah, and I think I saw it with my wife probably right after we got married.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good, yeah.
Yes.
So I've seen it, and then I saw it recently. I rented it. I thought it was on Netflix, and it's not.
It is not. No. Mm-hmm. You had to pay the money. That's okay. Definitely worth a rewatch, but that's good that you're familiar with it. But I think I should start off by describing the movie. It's a little bit difficult, but I want to make sure we get the premise up front because my mom will never let me forget the time that we waited till the end of the podcast to like say what the movie is about. She was so confused the whole time, so I have to. Thanks,
so we're
mom.
Gonna do this for your mom.
For my mom.
Can you like say
yeah.
something
it's,
nice
it's
to your
Valentine's
mom?
It's Valentine's
right
Day,
now?
And I just want to say my mom is the reason that I'm here today talking about movies because we grew up watching movies together, and so thanks, mom.
So I love that.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
It's true.
It's like La La Land.
There's no question
it's like his
about
aunt,
it.
But it's your mom.
Yes, it's
or
my
her
mom.
Aunt. But yeah, okay, whatever.
All right. So
beautiful.
The plot of the movie, basically. This movie, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, is about a man who, his name is Joel, and he is in a relationship with a girl named Clementine, and the relationship goes sour, and both of them decide to have their memory erased. There's a company that does this, a special doctor. They don't explain the science of it. It's just there. There's a company that can do this. And Clementine does it first, and Joel kind of does it out of retaliation. And so the movie takes place, most of it, inside Joel's head, because this company comes at night. He takes a sedative. He's sleeping in his bed, and this company erases all of his memories of Clementine over the course of the evening. And so we see an outside perspective of Joel, like, or what's happening outside of with the technicians erasing, but we also are inside Joel's head as he's kind of aware of his memories of Clementine going one by one, beginning with the most recent memories to the first memories.
So it's kind of like he's on a quest to save the memories of the person that he loves.
Yeah, because once they start going, he realizes the weight of what he's losing, and he basically tries, he realizes he doesn't want to do this, but he can't stop it. And so he and Clementine, inside his head, are on a quest, like you said, to kind of find a way to save their love inside his head. That's the premise, and that kind of a premise can only come from the great mind of Charlie Kaufman. There's no other person that can write something like that. So let's talk about Charlie Kaufman.
All right.
Are you familiar with his work?
I've watched adaptation, and I have seen this one. And what is name some other ones?
Being John Malkovich.
Seen Being John Malkovich
was the first big one.
That was a trip.
It was crazy.
So different than what I've ever seen before.
Oh, I know. That movie, which is about someone discovering a portal into John Malkovich's head, who plays himself. So weird, that movie. Like, it's disturbing, like, how weird it is. Like,
I love it.
Just leaves you...
I love it.
It leaves you weirded out. And then there's adaptation, right. Adaptation was great because, so Charlie Kaufman in real life was trying to write a screenplay about this book called The Orchid Thief, which is basically like a book about flowers. And he could not figure out how to write this book. Like, how do you make dramatic tension out of a book that's basically about flowers? And so he ended up cheating and writing a story about him writing an adaptation of this book about flowers.
It's a writer's block movie.
And it actually works and won a ton of award nominations and everything. And it's like, dude, you totally cheated and you got away with it and everyone called you a genius. How dare you?
It's funny because there's other movies like that I like. Like, is it Barton Fink?
That Barton
is
Fink,
that's
right.
Another writer's block movie.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's not Tim Robbins. That's John, I don't forget that guy's. John Turturro.
Yeah,
yes,
and then that's
Barton
a Coen,
Fink.
It's a Coen Brothers movie.
That's a good movie.
Yeah, yeah. So these writer's block movies, they seem to be part of like this genre of smart writers. Makes sense.
Which are very inspirational as writers, by the way. Adaptation is a great movie if you are struggling to write something or just a writer in general. It's a great movie. And then this was basically the third movie after that. So his third screenplay, he didn't direct any of those. He wrote strictly him writing the movies. Mm-hmm. Eternal Sunshine was the third one. And this is the one for me, I remember thinking this way back then, and I think it again now, where everything came together. So the first two movies, Being John Malkovich and Adaptation, were directed by Spike Jonze, who did most recently, I think Her would be the one that would be most recent. And then this one was directed by Michel Gondry.
Yep.
And I feel like this is the time where everything comes together, where Charlie Kaufman's kooky ideas meet a director who really understands how to capture the emotion of it. And I feel like the head and the heart kind of for the first time come together, where I feel like his first two movies are very much head trips, but lacking a soul. That's
my opinion. Gondry, his background's like in music videos, right?
Yes.
So before this, he's like making music videos that have to like in 2.5 minutes get this incredible emotional reaction.
Good point. Yes, that's what it's all about when you're making a music video. You don't have enough time, right?
And you're dealing with impressions rather than plot lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to come out of it with an emotion. And not necessarily with like this, because you don't have enough time to develop a character.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to come out of that music video with an emotion.
From the visuals.
With a feel.
Yeah.
Which I think, like I was telling you earlier before we started the podcast, like one of the critics said, I watched this movie and 2 days later, the entire content of the movie had evaporated, but I was left with I still had the emotion of the movie here and he had to watch it again.
Yeah. What a compliment.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I think Gondry's like, I think you're exactly right, John. Like, he's the right person to do this movie.
Mm-hmm. But the writing is fantastic. I mean, there's just so many great, you know, it's one of those scripts that the lines stand out to you. Like, you remember when he asks, is there any risk of brain damage? And the doctor's like, well, technically speaking, the procedure is brain damage.
This won't be worse than a night of heavy drinking, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Or when he tells Clementine, talking constantly isn't the same as communicating.
Yeah.
Like, that's a brilliant line. And yeah.
The writing sounds like actual relationship, like where you're having a real fight, and it comes off as someone's deeply insulting someone else, but they're talking like abstractions.
Mm.
So even Clementine, what does he say when they're talking about having a kid in one of the memories?
Mm-hmm. Well, he
do you really think you could be a mother?
Right.
Like, that's like a huge commentary on the person that you are with.
For sure.
So do you really think you could be a mother of a person?
And it's
like
one of
you?
Those moments where you say it, and the minute it comes out of your mouth, you're like, there it is.
Yep. Well, I mean, it's a huge value judgment on another human being.
Right, right.
And so he like you see, he doesn't talk a lot, and then sometimes he'll hit with these huge value judgments. And she the same, but in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so he can be incredibly judgmental.
Yes.
Of her. And then she she's not very she doesn't have a lot of understanding for him as far as like that he needs space and he needs to be reflection time. And it's mm-hmm. not, he's an introvert. He's not an extrovert like she is.
Right.
So it takes two people to have different personalities, mm-hmm. which I think is really interesting. Incredibly different personalities.
Right, because Joel is this introverted guy who basically like, yeah, he's reserved, but he's attracted to Clementine because she's outgoing, she's outspoken, she says what she means. It's like a part of him wants what she has, but he's also kind of annoyed by it. Like, right?
She's a performer.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
he's a reflector. Mm. And so like, how do these two beings, these forces, because they are forces in their own, how do they... Like, could they be in love? Could they maintain love? Could it's just, it looks doomed in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks absolutely doomed.
That's the heart of the movie right there. I know. I will say that when Charlie Kaufman transitioned later on in his career to being a director, I was not fond of his work. I think he's better in the writing capacity. Like Synecdoche, New York, I did not appreciate that film. Although someone recently told me, one of our writers actually for Cinema Movie told me that you have to watch it again, that it reveals things on the more viewings. But
I'm really terrible. I think I've watched that half a time.
Okay.
It doesn't count.
Uh-huh.
And I have people telling me to watch it all the time.
Yes,
and,
I know.
And I've just really been lazy about it.
But I did not. It was a very miserable first-time experience for me. But so he's transitioned into kind of a writer-director. We'll see how that goes. But this was kind of early in his career. So, yeah. So the way – I just feel like the way the story is constructed is absolutely genius. We start off by meeting Joel, and he's like wakes up, gets out of bed, skips work.
What day is it?
Yeah.
It's Valentine's Day.
Exactly. Yes. Thank you. And he's in a funk, and he meets this girl on a train, and she's got like crazy hair, like red hair, and right away we just get so much out of these characters in that first scene, right? We know that's I think a sign of great writing is we know everything we need to know about these characters in one scene. Amazing on that train.
Yeah, you find out that Joel's a little fearful.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of he's anxiety driven. He's fearful. Clementine wants is kind of boisterous, but also like she's unthinking. So she doesn't like, she does something that's like really a big gesture, and then she hasn't really thought it through.
Uh huh.
So in some ways, she's brave, but not necessarily calculated.
Yeah.
And so, like, so you see all that through these, like, this dialogue, how he stays in one seat on the train, and she keeps switching seats throughout the train.
Yes.
But he's witty, so uh-huh. he can banter with her.
But then he gets a little scared, right? Like, he puts himself out there a little too much, and then he kind of closes down and is like, oh, I should get back to my writing. And then she's like, oh, okay, no problem. And then she, like, punches him in the shoulder, and he's like, what? And that's just their dynamic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then it gets really weird. So you have this amazing kind of sweet first love, and then all of a sudden things take a turn, and only Charlie Kaufman could. We skip ahead seemingly to the end of their relationship where they're immersed in problems. And then all of a sudden we realize this whole erasing thing, and we get inside Joel's head, and we start off with erasing the memories that are most painful, that are most recent, which works so well because we're Joel is, like, we understand this is how annoying Clementine can be, this is why this relationship doesn't work. But as we progress throughout the film, which is really going backwards in their relationship, we, like Joel, suddenly start to see what's beautiful about their relationship, and we don't want it, just like Joel suddenly doesn't want it because we see they had something special and it's all going away. Yeah.
So I think it's, I love that writing because it's like the first scene of like encountering one another is actually they've already encountered each other for 2 years.
Yeah, spoiler alert, which is fine because you had so long to see this movie. Don't even worry about it. Yeah,
but that first scene, I mean, that's like a brilliant way to do it. And he's not hiding anything. And I read that, if you guys remember the movie Memento, which basically you can watch it if you want to watch
1999.
It.
Yeah. We were talking about 1999 a few minutes ago. Unbelievable.
So Memento actually was written after this movie, but this movie didn't get produced until later. And when Kaufman saw Memento, he's like, oh, we're toasted. Because there are some similar ideas and timelines and stuff like that. Except with this movie, Memento uses time to hide what has been going on. And this movie doesn't necessarily do that. This movie kind of, there are some ahas, but there's not a ton of that. It's more of like, it's just, I think having that scene in the beginning is to show that there is something still there, even post-memory erasing, right?
Yeah, it is confusing on the first viewing. It takes you a little bit of time to get like your bearings.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Which is, but once you do, it just reveals layer upon layer and everything makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just love that first scene. And then that they work backwards.
Yeah.
And I think we tend to do that, like, as in our relationships, as we think of the most recent negative interaction or positive interaction as being defining in the entire relationship. As human beings, we do that.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't go back and go, oh, well, what about this? This is this positive thing. This was beautiful. Another critic I was reading about said that their relationship, there isn't anything particularly romantic about their relationship. Very mundane.
Yeah, yeah. It's romantic in all the little ways that our relationships are romantic. All their little inside jokes about, like, you know, strangling each other with pillows and just the simple minutiae of it. That's what makes a relationship, yeah.
Yeah, and some of it's, like a little twisted. So even there's this, like, real... There's a scene... a lot of it is admitting... So you take Clementine, she's admitting that she doesn't feel pretty in one of the scenes. And... then Joel's character is like, no, you are pretty. And it's a really simple scene, but it's somebody who's being very vulnerable and who's normally like way out there and would never admit weakness.
That's true.
So she's incredibly vulnerable. And then he's not used to giving emotional affirmation and he does.
Mm-hmm.
And so like that becomes like one of his favorite memories. It's like where he's actually not, he's somehow the relationship has allowed both of them to be something that they haven't, that they're not normally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Let's talk about the visuals, because I think Michel Gondry's direction, and there's a cinematographer, his name is Ellen Kuras. It's just so crucial to the way everything develops. Like, so because the film takes place so much inside Joel's head, you have to communicate that visually, right? And I just think it's mind-blowing how the scenes will dissolve into each other, right? They'll be like in bed, that romantic scene you were talking about, and then all of a sudden their bed will be in the middle of the beach, which is in the middle of winter, and it's so real to how this would happen inside your head. And it's like, but it's subtle in a way too. Like, they'll be in a bookshop and you'll just little by little the book titles will go.
Yep.
But you don't even notice it because you're concentrating on what they're saying, and before you know it, he's surrounded by just a bunch of white books.
Yeah.
That's beautiful, the visuals. Yeah.
And that would be like our memory, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I look at, you know, we basically are creating memory all the time.
That's so weird when you put it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and then we're also losing memory. Although some people say, well, you're really losing it. But if you think about it, like every, you know, every moment we're probably losing some level of our memory,
right,
or it gets dulled. And so that's like very much accurate what he's doing. It's like, okay, we got the essence of this conversation. Oh, look, all the books are all gone.
Yeah.
And so they get dulled out over time. And I think that's like pretty true to real life. And I think relationships in that way, like there's things I don't remember. Like, I don't know if you've ever, you know, I was hanging out with some old friends like 2 weeks ago and they were telling me things that happened and I just didn't remember. So it's like we do lose these memories of people who are really significant to us.
And then the character who was inside his head that he never saw his face, he can't see his face inside his head, right? He tries to pull him close and it's like it won't happen. So yeah, it's very strict to what is actually inside his head. Yeah.
It's like a dream.
Yeah. I love the tone of the movie too. Like, this film is literally creepy, funny, romantic, beautiful, quirky. Like, it's all of those things. Can you say that about most movies? Like, it covers the gamut. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's tonally, it's very different than things that we're not used to this tone.
Yeah. Yep.
It has some kind of grotesque gothicness to it.
Yes.
But it's very light, and it's actually filmed kind of like a, like even the color schemes are very rainbowy childhood color schemes. And then it also draws a whole lot from like 70s, because their childhoods were in the 70s, probably early 70s. So it's like all this really like pastels and greens and yellows, and even when they're even talking about it, once you, I love this kitchen. But those so you have these really bright kind of almost circusy colors, but in the backdrop of this horrible thing of losing your love and all these memories.
Yeah.
So I think that's quite intentional.
Yeah. And in, especially if a movie, if the, primarily the movie taking place inside your head, it would be with a gamut of emotions, but I really feel like Gondry's in control the whole time. It doesn't feel like knee jerk or like you have whiplash. Like it feels like you cover all the emotions, but it all works like in the whole, you know?
Like, yeah. And then the places to, I mean, they go through like all these different emotions, Joel's emotions, which are pretty interesting.
So yeah.
Where he hides in shame all the time?
Because they're trying to run away from to get to a place inside Joel's head where they can't be found. And so they go, he goes back to shame.
Yeah. I also like the imagery is like really powerful. So if you look at the cover of the DVD and on the posters and stuff, they're on the Charles River. And apparently, like, the weather cooperated with this film. So they had like a really cold winter, and it froze the river. And the image that they use for the movie itself is Clementine, and Joel, and they're on the ice. They're laying on the river, and there's this huge crack.
Yeah,
it's like all fractured, and it's like the idea of it that like this is this imperfect fractured thing, but they're together. And so it becomes like this metaphor for the movie.
It's perfect.
Yeah, it is. It's like beautiful. And so I didn't even catch that. Like I caught the, like I'm very dense, and I caught that like this viewing, this last one.
That happens to me all the time.
Cause I was looking for it. Right. And I was like, oh, there it is. Whoa. Uh-huh. That's pretty intense. And they probably hadn't like planned that when they saw it. They're like, yes, this is it right here. And they did this, and they have it's from like a bird's eye perspective.
Right over top. Yeah.
And it's like, this is what this is. And the fracture is just as, you know, just as apparent as they are.
Yeah.
And in fact, it would be in the center of the thing, and they're on the side.
And it made the cover. So let's talk about the acting. Jim Carrey. Okay. I was not, you know, the big buzz around this time was that Jim Carrey in a super serious role, right? Because it's always interesting to us when a comic actor becomes serious for us. But he, of course, Jim Carrey was huge when I was in high school with the Ace Ventura movies and The Mask and everything. Were you a fan of him in his big, broad comedy days?
Dumb and Dumber.
Liar, Liar. Dumb and Dumber, right.
Yeah,
yes.
So I think there is like the... There's this side of him that's like Jerry Lewis, like the next incarnation of Jerry Lewis, right? Like where he's like goofing, like he's a physical goofy comic.
I hated all those movies. I'm sorry.
Well, I think like probably being a junior higher when I saw most of those, or maybe like early high school, it was like totally great. But I think that's like physical comedy was his deal.
Yeah, for sure. And this wasn't, to be fair, his first serious role. He did Majestic is a movie that you never saw, but he was serious.
I saw it. It's a good movie.
Yep, I heard. And then Truman Show came out before this. And so that was kind of more of a foray into that as well. But this was, I think, his most intensely serious performance where he really laid it all out there. He was very vulnerable in this movie. And I think it works really well for the character too, because he's Jim Carrey, because we're so used to him, you know, talking out his butt literally, that seeing him closed up and withdrawn adds in like an extra punch because it's Jim Carrey.
It's possible. I know that when they're talking about how do you direct Jim Carrey, I know I was reading something about Gondry had to tell him that this is not a comedy. He would keep saying this is not a comedy, and then he would say to Winslet, hey, you need to go a little bigger. Like this is
to Winslet. This is a comedy.
Yeah, this is a comedy. This is a comedy. So that she could be like more over the top, and so that he would be more reserved. And apparently, he was like miserable filming this.
Really?
Yeah.
It shows. It's good.
I guess that's what you wanted.
Absolutely.
Because he's supposed to be miserable. So to see him like
And Kate Winslet is great. And you're right. It worked because she is more carefree than I think any role I can remember. And she usually is always super serious. And because she's a great actress, you know, Titanic and the whole nine yards. But yeah, she's like just a free spirit in this movie. I love it.
Yeah, she's a free spirit to a point, but then she also is like, why does she always need a guy?
Hmm.
You know? So it's like, how free is she?
And that becomes a source of tension in their relationship.
Yeah,
right?
It really does.
Yeah. She was nominated for an Oscar. He was not, but she was. And Charlie Kaufman did win Best Screenplay for this as well. But and then you have a bunch of interesting side characters. So I love Mark Ruffalo in this movie, Tim.
I love him too.
I just can't get enough of him in this.
I know.
My wife and I never stop laughing when he comes on. I love... Okay, so... Mark Ruffalo, who, by the way, is from Kenosha, Wisconsin. Fun fact.
I didn't know that, but that...
Okay, true story.
Wow.
He and Elijah Wood play these sort of technicians who are just...
Creepy. They're creepy
people.
Man.
And they're the ones that are actually, like, messing with this poor man's brain, and they don't have a brain themselves. But, like, so his character, Mark Ruffalo's character's name is Stan, and there's this one scene that I love. So Kirsten Dunst is in this movie, too, and so Stan wants his girlfriend, Kirsten Dunst, to come over, and so he gets rid of Elijah Wood's character, and then him... Mark Ruffalo and Kirsten Dunst are dancing in their underwear on top of poor Joel as he's got his like eraser thing on his head, just like oblivious.
It's like they treat like erasing memories from Joel's head. It's like kind of like, oh wow, we get the manager's gone from McDonald's and we can
that's
just like
it.
Screw around.
That's it. Yeah, Elijah Wood like cranks up the knob and he's like, don't want to roach the guy, man.
Right, it's like doing brain damage to this guy, and they're not even paying attention. It's like they're it's like they're, it's kind of immoral the way
it
they're
is.
Acting.
It is,
and but they've like violated all the like his personhood. Basically.
Yeah, they're like raiding right in his fridge,
eating food on his bed, like smoking weed. I mean, it's just like
I
totally
love it.
Disrespecting him.
And then there's my favorite part is Elijah Wood calls. He's like, oh, is it okay if I don't come back for a bit? And he's like, yeah, yeah, I gotta go. And he goes back to dancing. I love it.
Yeah, that is a good Ruffalo. That's my first memory of him in a movie.
Yeah, me too. Totally.
And I was like, who is that guy? And he looks so cool. He has a jacket. And
he does look cool with his glasses and his hair. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he's like the nerdy, unkempt guy. Uh-huh. He really played it well.
Yeah.
He's like his grad student that doesn't feels like no sense of real empowerment, but like has all the technical skills.
Right. That's such a good way to put it. Yeah. For sure. Elijah Wood didn't really do anything for me. I was starting to think as I was watching this, like, has Elijah Wood ever done anything that was like, wow, what a performance? I mean, he, of course, Lord of the Rings.
Frodo. As a kid, he did like Huck Finn. He did a bunch of stuff as a kid.
North. Bruce Willis. Oh, what was it? It was in Deep Impact. Remember when I had that like 1-2 punch of like Armageddon and Deep Impact? And then we had like Volcano and... what was the other volcano movie?
This goes into my like Dante's Peak.
Dante's Peak.
This goes into like it's like the catastrophic. We've got to send a team to like fight the natural, like drill a hole in a meteor. This is like a whole
but one movie's not enough.
Stand.
We got to have two, right?
And they got to compete during the summertime with exactly the same plot line. Yeah, miserable. I'm so glad it's over with.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, Elijah Wood. What I would say is like it's really hard to break out of the the Frodo.
I know. He has such a weird, articulate way of talking that's almost a distraction. You know what I mean?
It's
kind of mean, but I'm sorry.
Well,
sorry, Elijah.
It's hard for him to be like, he has to play this. He's good for this role because he's a little weaselly.
He's a little creepy weasel, right?
Yeah.
For sure.
And so, yeah. And he's definitely like, oh, he's a hobbit.
Basically, he's a human hobbit.
Yeah.
Right,
okay. But he's a little weaselly. You're kind of like, you could believe that Elijah Wood couldn't get the girl unless he like had a scheme.
Yeah. 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 That's
point. Would be his primary way was to like, to trick someone.
He's like evil Frodo. And
yeah. He's like tricking people into like a relationship using their memories. I mean, that's like really creepy.
It is.
I think he's a good choice to be.
Yeah. He plays his role fine. It's me.
My guess is he's also desperate for like a real role that doesn't involve him putting like pointed ears and hairy feet on.
Probably. Yeah. Post Lord of the Rings, there's been some drought. I remember he was in this movie called Grand Piano where he played this like, he had to keep playing the piano or this guy, what was the guy from Say Anything? We were talking about him last week. John Cusack's the evil villain, and he's going to kill him if he plays one wrong note.
Oh
yeah. Wow. It's a really dumb B movie. Don't watch it anyway.
Deal.
Okay.
Yeah, I won't watch it.
So Favorite moments. You have any favorite moments from this movie? Like one scene or two scenes that just stand out to you above all else?
I think when there's that scene, the scene where they go to the mansion in Montauk, it's the last memory.
Yes, that's mine too. But tell your take of it and I'll do mine.
It's a scene of regret. And so he's too afraid. So he first meets her. He's already in a relationship with somebody else, but he doesn't love that person. He meets Clementine this first day they meet, and they spend all the, it's kind of magical. And they really instantly connect. And then it's getting really cold outside. And so like, oh, let's break into the mansion, right? And so they break into this other people's mansion. They drink the wine. And she's like, oh, I'm going to go see what's upstairs. And when she comes back, he left.
Yeah.
And the idea is like, and then they talk about it.
That's what's so great. Yeah. Within the memories, he's in the memory, but he also is able to be outside of the memory, which is what's so great about it.
Right. Yeah. And that scene is like so, like the idea that Clementine would break into someone's house and drink their wine is so her. It's like totally embodies who she is. And it's so, and then the risk of that produces so much anxiety in him that he has to run. And in this last scene, like where he's having all his memories erased and that's his last memory of her, he's like, I wish I had stayed. So the idea is like, I wish I had taken the risk. I wish I had drawn closer to you where you were at. And I think it's just a really beautiful scene.
Yeah,
it is. Like, I should have stayed. And so that that scene of memory is like really, that's kind of I hate to use the term magical because it's a little cliche, but I think it feels that way.
It is. That I totally feel the same way. That scene grabbed me too. My favorite part of that scene isn't even what you described. It's when he's in the car ride on the way home. So his friends brought him to the party. That's where he meets Clementine for the first time. And I love how you have basically his friends are just talking about, you know, whatever, some random nonsense. Like the movie kind of drowns them out, but they're just making small talk. And he's just staring out the window thinking, he's just lost in that moment that we've all experienced, you know, where you first meet someone, where you were going down this path, you were alone. He was in a relationship, but for all intents and purposes, he was alone. And then you meet someone and there's a spark between you and you know that nothing's going to be the same. And you're just lost in that magical feeling, that first love feeling that I don't think you ever can top, that just like pure rush of blood to the head feeling, you know?
Yeah.
And so he's in the car and so his friends are talking. And then one of his friends says, hey, I saw you talking to someone pretty, you know, who was that? And he's just like, oh yeah, she was just a girl, you know? And there's something so beautiful about that moment because you realize this is his first memory of her, but it's also his last memory that he'll ever remember of her. And it's this melancholy, but beautiful. Yeah. It is. There's something magical about that whole scene. Yeah.
And the music. We talked about the music.
John Bryan, amazing score. Yes. Yeah.
So do you want to talk a little bit about like where this movie came from a little bit?
Yeah,
like,
for it, man.
And like even the title and all those things?
Yes.
So this movie, it's like there's tons of literary allusion. It's like very, very much a writer's movie. But, you know, and they even like give us all the clues. They give us a Nietzsche quote and then they give us a Alexander Pope quote. And they're very like, Kaufman's very intent that we get it. So he like emphasizes her, that she messed it up, the Kirsten Dunst. And it comes from this poem that's Alexander Pope poem about Abelard and Heloise. And so anyway, I read the poem this week.
Do you want me to read the quote?
You can. Yeah, go ahead.
All right. How happy is the blameless vessel's lot, the world forgetting by the world forgot, eternal sunshine of the spotless mind, each prayer accepted and each wish resigned. It's a beautiful quote. And it's played over this scene where they're like downtown and there's like elephants in the street. And it's like she reads that quote over that. So it's a beautiful moment. Go ahead.
Yeah. So like I'm wondering like, so that's the idea of like erasing your memory, like that you'd have this eternal sunshine, a spotless mind, a vessel, like a vessel virgin. So like somebody who's been like saved, like is a pure mind like the whole love affair between Peter Abelard, who's like this like theologian, philosopher, a total medieval like scholastic, That's like the real guy, right? And that he would have fallen in love with Heloise. I guess, I don't know if she was a nun. I think that's right. And he actually got castrated.
What?
Yes, because he wanted to be with her, and her family like basically castrated him.
Oh, no.
And so then they basically removed, and they lived a life devoted to like in monastic orders. And so this is like the background of this whole poem, right? So it's like kind of, and we get some sources on this. So I don't know how accurate it is, but that whole idea, and then they began this correspondence between one another, is that they had this deep love. They were willing to lose identity for it, and they still loved each other, even though, and they were trying to love God as much as they loved each other, which is wild, right?
Wow.
But I think one of the things that's significant about it is, you know, as I'm looking at it is, first off, they had this love, and it was like against the world a little bit, like us against the world, which is like, that's not a new deal, but
yeah.
But I think the thing that's really significant is that Alexander Pope is like considered one of the forerunners in the Romantic movement. So when you say like there was this spark, there was this feeling, I think that's what we're trying to get here. So over and against like this, like the Enlightenment thinking, which was like highly empirical, methodological, we must trust, we can only trust our senses. We can't trust any kind of innate sense of like, even the idea of love is questioned, right? And I think that we see Pope is questioning that, and he says, no, emotion matters. And in the end, like love beats the machine, right?
Hmm.
They meet in Montauk.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm not trying to, especially with a Christian podcast, I don't want to like place science in opposition to like love or something. But what I would say is like, does empiricism triumph or is love triumph? And so you take like the, like one of the preeminent scholastics of the medieval era, and his love drives him to a place that his academics or even his reason could not.
To a point where it's almost unexplainable. How could Clementine whispering "Meet me in Montauk" even drive them both to Montauk? And yet, there you go. Right.
Right. It's like even unconscious. It's like they're drawn.
Yeah.
And so anyway, but I think there's those ideas like I think are permeate that film, which is like what you take the most reasonable, rational person who has all the quotes already memorized. You mean Alexander Pope and his love? He has a loveless marriage. And he's having affairs with like the interns.
The technician guy who's like the head of the company, right? Yeah, yeah.
And the guy's like a scientist, and he's like, but he cannot maintain his marriage, and his wife hates his guts. And he's having affairs, and he's erasing people's minds when they find out that they had an affair. I mean, it's just like miserable. And all that science cannot like triumph over this love, wow. Which I think is really interesting.
I love that.
Yeah.
What else stands out to you from a thematic perspective?
The idea of being broken, and also that love, that there's a component of love that is brokenness and forgiveness and acceptance. So, which you get in the final scenes, but you also get it, like you get hints of that throughout the whole thing. Is like at first you normally see a scene where like that, like you build up the love and then it gets like challenged by something and then love overcomes.
Yeah.
This is like implicit in their love is brokenness. So like they're walking and having a date and they're walking through the market in New York or whatever, or maybe it's not New York. I don't remember. I think it is. And they're walking through this market and they're strolling along and like kind of on a lover's walk. And then like one of them levels some horrible criticism against the other one. Right.
Right.
And it like sours the interaction. And I think that like that's much more like real love. It's like, now where do we go? Do we keep going or do we not keep going? That actually, to me, mirrors more like what reality is like than what we usually see in a love story.
Yes. Yeah. It's so true. It really, the movie is so honest about relationships more than any other quote romantic film. That's what I was alluding to at the beginning. And that's why this is coming to your listening ears on Valentine's Day, because I think it really gets to the heart of it. Like, why are these two attracted to each other? Like we talked about, Joel, there's something that's so attractive to Clementine about that he wants. He wishes he was more assertive. He wishes he could do what Clementine does. And Clementine wishes, I think, that she could be a little more grounded like Joel, right? But yeah. They both are attracted to that, and then they're repulsed by it. And it's like, well, I'm sure all of our listeners are good progressives who love the Enneagram. So I'm gonna.
Oh no, you might be like you might be getting too specific for our listeners.
I'm sorry. I love the Enneagram, and anyway, so
it's like a personality tool.
Well, that's a crude way of putting it. But
I'm trying to be quick.
It's fine. It's fine. Read the book by Ian Cron and Suzanne Stabile. It's a great book. Anyway, so the Enneagram. But basically, in Enneagram language, the best part of you is the worst part of you.
There's a dark side and a light side in like Christian mysticism.
That's what they say. Yeah. Yes. And so I feel like and it's just like, let's say, so with Joel and Clementine, I feel like that their relationship fails because once you get past that attraction phase, like, okay, so let's just take my relationship, for instance, with my wife. So my wife is a 9 on the Enneagram, and I'm a 6, and I'm kind of drowning in fear a lot and pessimism, but my wife is carefree, and she's like a peacemaker, and she's all like, it's all
that.
Good,
I
right?
I can see that.
Yeah, and it works. But at the same time, my wife also, when there's something that really needs to get done, that's my forte, right? Because I see like all the ramifications if this thing doesn't get done, but she is like, oh well,
it'll all work out.
And so that thing that I love about her also can become annoying when something has to get done, right? And that's how it is. It's like you churn your best straight on its side, and it can become your worst thing too. And so I think that's what it is with Joel and Clementine. And what's so great is the way the movie's constructed. At the end, they see all of their flaws. So they've just met in their minds. And they see all their flaws presented to each other because they both learn that they've gotten each other erased through a series of events. And their tapes, they're literally their tapes of why they got their memories erased, are playing in the background. And they have to listen to all of the things that they're going to be so annoyed with, you know, a year down the road or whatever.
And they're like deeply insulting.
Yeah, yeah, they're horrible things.
So they're listening to the voice of themselves deeply insult their partner.
Yes. And they have to basically look at each other and say, can we do this? And Clementine says, she's like, you're going to get annoyed with me on this. And you're going to hate it when I do that. And Joel says, okay. And she says, okay. And they laugh. And that's so beautiful, right? Isn't that like basically what love in a sinful world with broken people is? Is you basically, you look at each other's flaws and you say, okay.
I always, because this movie's 2004, right?
Yeah, 2004.
So one of the things I was thinking about is like, so this is before, like, there is some social media, but not to the degree of that we have it now. And I was thinking about the idea of like erasing friendships. And like the idea of destroying the record of people's lives. And you could do that online now, like in your social media. You could like destroy it, unfriend people. And the idea of like real relationship is this the dynamic interaction with disagreement, with flawed people, with its vulnerability. It's not perfection. It's not erasing somebody's memory. Every time you make a mistake, you erase memories. And I think that, can you imagine, it's like every time you erased, to me, it's like this, it takes you out of the realm of real life if you're going back and erasing all the time.
Right. It kind of gets to what that quote is about. We can kind of socially engineer our lives nowadays to remove any unpleasantness, any people that we disagree with, and yep, we can have an echo chamber where everyone thinks and acts exactly like us. Mm-hmm. Which is scary, and I don't think it's healthy. I don't think it's what we were created for.
Or happiness could, you can have happiness as long as like is harmony is not happiness.
Yeah.
So you know, for all these people, they want harmony. They don't want to feel pain. Mm-hmm. And so this movie would say, no, pain is part of love.
Yep.
And in fact, I mean, you think about Abelard and Heloise, like they're spending most of their relationship apart and longing to be together. So it's like this pain actually is fueling their fire in some ways. Hmm. So I look at like pain is a necessary part of human relationship. And I think we try to limit the pain. And the moment we experience any kind of pain, we try to run away or delete. Or, you know, whatever way, you know, we would take or get it, just get out of the relationship. And this would be like, no, that's not what that's actually part of it.
I was thinking even from like to take it to a super Christian level, you know how we believe that at the end of all things, Jesus will actually restore all of creation and humanity to the way things are supposed to be. I wonder if we will still have the memories of the brokenness. will, you know, because I think that's a part of what will make eternity beautiful.
So I guess this, you know, I think about, is it implicit in the Christian message, vulnerability and suffering? Like, do we have to have that in order to have real redemption occur? Do we have to be vulnerable? And I think about Christ, I think, okay, he's vulnerable enough to like have the incarnation occur. So entering into our sufferings, entering into our brokenness, all of our junk, and then saying, yeah, I'd do this. And then I also think about like in willingness to suffer in order to bring about right relationship and redeem, and all of creation be redeemed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's something like when we are willing to enter into this consistent long-term relationship with one another that doesn't forsake one another when things get difficult or when things are hard or when it's a lot uglier than we thought it was going to be. There's something that is like Jesus in that.
Yes.
Even though we're messed up, like beyond, right? But there's also something beautiful that we have that ability to follow Jesus in that way. And that other people would do the same for us. Like, because we all know these moments where we have had really, we've been very ugly in lots of ways.
Yeah.
And we have said things and we've done things. And the fact that like that can get redeemed in that, and that there's value in still to keep going, that there's value in that. I really love that about this movie, because that's like a lot more difficult than You've Got Mail. And right.
Even when Harry Met Sally. Yeah, for right. sure.
It's like, it's not so lovable as we talk about Tom Hanks basically every podcast.
We do.
So it's not like Sleepless in Seattle. It's not like a, you know, handsome single father with a good sense of humor on a houseboat. That's easy, right?
Yeah.
This is more difficult.
Yep.
This is more broken. This is more real. It's not the like an ideal situation. It's actually quite the opposite.
Mm.
But is love strong enough for that?
Yeah. So final thoughts, man. Go. Your letter grade and your final thoughts on the film. It's all you.
Strong A. I don't know. You know, I'm not. I don't know what your A plus. Your A plus is like the best of all. I forget your definition of A plus. But I would say it's an A. I'd say it's in the top five films of the 2000s. And my final thoughts on it would be that you should watch it twice. Watch it like once and then like a week later watch it again. Which is going to cost you money.
Well, you get a 48-hour rental.
Yeah, library. You what? Right. Yes, right.
Garage sale. That's what you suggested last time.
Garage sale. I'm telling you, man. If you like standard definition, this is your place to go. Is the garage sale?
Yeah, yeah.
You can hit up Sharehouse Goods online. That's one of our local places, and they have a lot of DVDs and Blu-rays. But I would say definitely watch it twice, and you can watch some of the other Kaufman stuff. But definitely, this is probably my favorite film of his, like adaptation as well. But definitely an A.
I completely agree. I think people will be talking about this movie 100 years from now. There's nothing similar to it that I can think of, and writing and directing is just out of this world. And like we talked about, it speaks about our humanity in a way that I think few films are even capable of doing. So it's a masterpiece, and it does get my A+.
Whoa.
Tim, my coveted A+. One of the best movies of all time. And you're right. I think if you're looking at the 2000s, that era, post-2000, this is in the top five for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Tree of Life would be up there.
Ah,
yeah. Yeah.
You didn't just say that.
I did.
Both impressionistic movies.
Love it.
Yeah.
So there you have it, man. This has been fun. So we've been able to start off the year kind of talking about two of my favorite movies, and I know that they aren't necessarily your two favorite movies, so maybe next time we can get to yours, because I appreciate you taking a stroll with me through my favorites. But
no, I love Eternal Sunshine.
Good.
Yeah, that's
not as Almost Famous as much, but that's okay.
Almost Famous is all right.
That's all right.
Like it.
You almost like it.
Yeah, it's great. Good.
So thanks for walking through with me. It's been kind of a nice retrospective series, and the Oscars are February 26th.
Goodness.
So that will be the night that we officially say goodbye to 2016. I mentioned we're still kind of in limbo period here, so watch the Oscars with us. We will be live tweeting on Oscar night.
Which, how do we follow you?
Well, you will go to twitter.com and @cinemafaith is where you'll hit us up. And that is where we will have live tweets throughout the entire Oscar broadcast.
And now, John, once again, how do we turn on the robots?
The robots, yes. So I know that this, what's so annoying is that every single podcast tells you to do this at the end, and I think it's become just like white noise when people get to this part of the podcast. That, but it is so important.
You need
important.
To tune in. Please tune in now. Forget what we said.
Please. I'm sorry. I know everyone wants you to do this, but it's because it's the only way to expand on iTunes is to go on iTunes and rate us and give us like a little 5-star thing and just write a sentence review. Honestly, my wife did this for us about a week ago, and it took her 3 minutes. She wrote one sentence about how amazing we are and did 5 stars, and that's all it takes.
And if you don't like John, you could talk about me.
That's fine.
It doesn't matter.
Just
the podcast, give it a good star rating.
Just doing that, all of a sudden, expands us out into another layer on iTunes or however it works, but it really is the only way. So please do that. So yeah, come swing by for some live tweeting on Oscar night, and then we will be done with 2016, and next month we will be officially kicking off 2017 with a brand new movie in theaters. I don't know which one yet, but
this is exciting.
This is the beginning of a new year, so that's great.
I can't wait, man.
So all right, great talking with you, Tim. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.